Well, good evening. Just a little background to this program. This lecture was really born out of an event that occurred about 10 years ago. Gentleman I know very well lives in a town which no one's ever heard of called Big Sandy, Texas. Even in Big Sandy, they never heard of it. It's all the way in East Eckville, Texas. This is not Dallas, you know, where you change your American Airlines flight on the way to Los Angeles. This is right about an hour away from the Louisiana border. Fellow who I had met there who had such a great love and intense connection to the Jewish faith that he made a decision that he was going to convert to Judaism. He had been very intensely involved in his church for all of his life. And we became very close. I even went down to Big Sandy, did a series of lectures at his home, which drew an unusual crowd. And even it was such a notable event that the Dallas Morning News sent their reporter down a couple of hours east to cover the event. And it was after that he had converted, he told me that in his church there was a Jewish woman who had converted to Christianity and was also considering returning back to her Jewish faith. However, when she had mentioned that she was considering embracing Judaism, her pastor quickly gave her a book called The New Covenant, a book that essentially attacks the faith of Israel, the Jewish faith, and attacks the Talmud, which is one of the most sacred works of Judaism. And he said to me that this book, because it describes the Talmud as a document which advocates some of the most hideous crimes, because this book advocates the notion that the Talmud advocates pedophilia, murder, racism, and other very, very bizarre acts, and because this woman herself was a victim of abuse, this was the impediment to her considering to return back to Judaism. She did not want to meet with me. She had studied my tapes, but she felt very uncomfortable actually sitting down with me. He begged me, would you please make an audio tape for her and go through the arguments that were made in this book and respond to them and refute them. And I told him that I would. I took a little tape recorder. I remember I sat down in a little room and I began to pour my heart out to her. It was a 90-minute tape because that's all I can get my hands on. I thought she only would need maybe not even the full one side of the tape. I thought maybe in 30 minutes, but it became almost a gushing, became a very emotional, personal experience for me. Baruch Hashem, that woman did tshuva and returned back to her heritage. Over the years, as you know, I've devoted my life to standing up for my people that both spiritually and physically are under assault. So when the church rose up and assaulted our faith by declaring that Tanakh, that the Jewish scriptures, proves that Jesus is the Messiah, I devoted my life to fighting this, as I'm sure almost all of you here know. And then when I saw how the Europeans were turning back to their old ways, and I saw how your newspaper here in Philadelphia and in Los Angeles and in New York were assaulting and smearing and besmirching the state of Israel. You should know, sweet children of Israel, that when the Toronto Star, when a journalist from the New York Times puts his pen on a piece of paper, you know that a Jew dies in the Holy Land. And I know that here in Pennsylvania there are all kinds of political issues, gun control. Is it too easy to get a gun here in this part of Pennsylvania? Maybe vouchers, why are you paying all this money in taxes on your real estate, and then you send your kids to a Jewish day school? There should be some sort of, you should be sub. These are all issues that, but I say this to you, that these issues are not nearly as important as what's happening in the Holy Land, where almost each and every day our people are dying. All the in years past, although I had made this tape, which what I thought was very important for this woman, I thought that these arguments and assertions made by those who would attack our faith, and specifically attack the sages of Israel, I thought these people were so on the extreme of society. They don't really represent anything that's significant that is occurring. So I never made that tape public, and it remained a private tape between myself and her. Over the last decade, much has happened. It's interesting that what is occurring is, as Christians in America, and I never dreamed I would ever say this to you, but I am, as Christians in America, particularly devout Christians, are becoming more philo-Semitic as a result of their Christian Zionism, which I never dreamed those words would leave my lips, because, as you know, most of my adult life has been devoted to fighting evangelical Christians, fighting for the souls of my people. But what's occurred over time is something very strange. The Gemara tells us that the outside affects the insides, and although so many evangelical conservative Christians became Zionists because they learned it in the pews of their churches, but what occurred was they became devoutly committed to the Jewish state and to the Jewish people, and as a result of that, it actually had an enormous impact on the character of many of these individuals, where many of them today are very sincerely devoted to the Jewish state, sincerely. And I've seen it, and I've heard it, and I know it's true. Now, there are many people from this genre who are not sincere, who have only one interest, and that's the conversion of the Jews in Israel, and it's to prepare Israel for the second coming of Jesus, and all kinds of theological issues. However, there's no doubt that in America today, there is an outpouring of love for Zion that is unfolding in Christian America. In Europe, the exact opposite is occurring. There was a survey done about a half a year ago. Almost all of you are familiar with it. It was a survey done of 15 European countries. Among these people, it was a huge survey. I think it was over 1,200 people were included in the survey. They asked what country in the world presented the greatest threat to world peace, and almost 60% said not North Korea. They didn't say Iran. They didn't say the Sudan, that at this moment, as I'm talking to you, Kindlach, there are black men and women that are being slaughtered in a genocide and sold into slavery. It's a very holy thing if you'll be involved in trying to free these people and even redeem these people. In the Arab world today, there is unbridled anti-Semitism, where claims are made openly that the Talmud advocates unspeakable crimes. And I am sorry to tell you that there are many messianic organizations, many Christian organizations in America that teach the very same thing. And therefore, I cannot remain silent any longer. This presentation is a necessity. People ask me the question, are the people who advocate that the Talmud would advance such hideous crimes, such bizarre things, which we'll discuss in a moment, are these people all anti-Semitic? I don't take that charge lightly. The answer is yes. Without exception, the people who advance these ideas are all viciously anti-Semitic. Logically speaking, there should be no need for a lecture like this. Monotheistic religions are generally not noted for being very tolerant. Generally speaking, and there are many exceptions to this, pagan religions historically have been very tolerant. If you believe that there is one God and there is no other and this is the only way, so it doesn't leave a lot of room for the Hare Krishnas. Doesn't leave a lot of room for the guys running around in airports with yellow shmatas on and sandals running around with paint on their head. And every Jew is walking by, oh, that poor mother, right? But if you believe in 185 different gods, so if somebody comes up with another, so you have 186, it basically doesn't disturb the whole rubric. So it doesn't, see another deity, so it's another one. However, although what I had told you is the case, Judaism is the notable exception because the Jewish faith teaches, as our sages tell us, the Gemara says, that you don't certainly, the word doesn't even have to say this, that you don't have to be Jewish to be right by God. Famous Talmud says in Sanhedrin that every one of you know this, that the righteous of all the nations have a place in the world to come. You know this, that if someone comes to a Rav, someone comes to a rabbi and says, I want to become a Jew, so the rabbi sends him away. Why? Because this is an exclusive club. No, the reason is, the basic reason is, there's no need for someone to be a Jew. A person can be right by God by worshiping the one God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and observing and being faithful to the seven basic Noahide laws. So if you're going to take someone who wants to convert to Judaism, and let's say today they drive on Shabbos and eat hamburgers from McDonald's, so there's no sin. If a rabbi is going to take such an individual and convert him to Judaism, and that person will drive on the Sabbath day and eat that which is not kosher and not feed the poor and not clothe the naked and not protect the orphan and the widow, God is going to require it of that person. So what rabbi wants to create sinners? It's better the person should be a Gentile. Judaism teaches that every person is created in the image of the Almighty. Christianity has been, until recently, our greatest oppressors. You should know that in Islam, they invent nothing. You can look in, when you go home, you look at your computer. When you get in your car, you can look in where your car was made. When you look at a medicine, you can look where the medicine was invented. Guarantee you, nothing came from Egypt and didn't come from, wasn't made in Libya. And medical advances that have saved your life and your family's life didn't come from Saudi Arabia. All the technology that these Arab countries have with the billions in petroleum is all imported. They contribute nothing to society. The only thing the Egyptians give us is some cotton. That's the end. The only maybe is, maybe in the only democracy in the Arab world, in France, we see something. In the exact same way, the anti-Semitism that we see that is launched against our people from the Islamic world, from the Arab world, it is all also plagiarized. None of it is original. When you see the caricatures in the Egyptian press, how the Jew is presented, it's in the way that the church did for 2,000 years. None of it is original. 2 years ago on Purim, there was in the front page of the Saudi Arabian, the main paper there, front page, whatever it was, the Riyadh Times, whatever they got there, the front page that the Jews use blood to make hamantash. They take the blood of Muslim children and they use it. You know what a hamantash is? The triangular cake that Jews eat on Purim. None of you know how to bake here. They say that the integral ingredient is blood. It is interesting that in Christianity and Islam, who launched these attacks, both of them teach that if you're not a Christian, you're in hell. There's no hope for you, sir. Mark 16, he's getting all depressed. Mark 16:16 says, if you believe and you're baptized, you're saved, and if you believe it's not, you're damned. You could be a nice person, you could be a fine individual, but if you don't believe, so 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, verse 8 says that you'll go into an eternal lake of fire. And the talk about glass houses and Revelations describes synagogues. We're standing in a synagogue now. Synagogues, according to Revelations, is really a den of Satan. It says that openly. And in John 8:44, it says that from the mouth of Jesus that the Jews are the seed of the devil. So you think that Christianity would have been more careful to not launch such invectives against the children of Israel, given their vulnerability. They shouldn't attack our sacred literature. And Islam and their teachings, both in the Quran and the Hadith, are outrageous. Jews are the children of monkeys and pigs and so on and so forth. What is the purpose of this?
They want to dehumanize.
Exactly. The purpose of this is to dehumanize the Jewish people. Because if there can be a modicum that the Jews have the truth, it can become very dangerous. And given that Christianity believes that 1 minute before Jesus was born, who had the truth? Every Christian would have to say, the Jews. And incidentally, they wouldn't say the Sadducees. And they wouldn't say some offbeat crazy group back then. They would have to tell you, wouldn't say the Essenes. They would say that the Pharisees, which are essentially Orthodox Jews. If you're sort of Reformed, don't be insulted. Those movements didn't exist back then. So therefore, there's a great credibility. And if you study racism, when I went to college and I studied, went to the school of social work, so the course I took that was most, I learned the most from was, I think I discussed this when I spoke about Mel Gibson's film, The Passion, last time I spoke in this town. So I explained that in order for a people to commit crimes against another, they must always dehumanize them, always. Someone believes that you're equal, then how could you perpetrate such crimes? How could you cut somebody's head off? That's why when the terrorists take, nab Jews and Christians, you look at them, they're cutting the heads off, not shooting them, which is more antiseptic, but cutting the heads off, and not cutting the heads off with a guillotine, but with a knife, and the most hideous thing. And I thank God that they film it. I feel like sending them more cameras because the world should know the truth. But how is it possible? How could it be? Because in their minds, these individuals are infidels. And therefore, they're dehumanized. Therefore, all crimes can be committed against them. But all the Muslims that they had kidnapped, all the people that belonged to the faith of the terrorists who were taken, were ultimately freed. None of them were murdered. Why? Because they couldn't dehumanize them, because they were worshiping in the way that they worshiped. I mentioned to you that one of the great ironies of World War II is that while the Europeans were murdering one-third of the Jew, all of European Jewry was destroyed. In 1940, there were roughly 18 million Jews in the world. By the end of 1945, there were 12 million. All of Polish Jewry was destroyed. Not only were the Jews couldn't get out, had no way to get to America. The doors in this country were closed since the mid-1920s. There was no escape. If you're here as a Jew, you probably, your family came here before the 1920s. Almost certainly so. The British had made sure that millions would die. Jews were trying to flee Hitler's ovens. They had nowhere to run. The land of Israel, the Holy Land, would have been a perfect place for them to escape. But in 1939, the British had signed the white paper. You have to know this. You have to know this in your head. So when you see the Tony Blairs and so on, make the statements, where are they coming from? So they passed a... Oh, it's an infamous paper, a white paper that restricted Jewish immigration to the land of Israel. I don't like using the word name Palestine, to essentially about 1,500 Jews a month, which basically sealed the fate of European Jewry. There was no way to get out. They didn't even allow the 1,500 that were in the quota. While this is occurring, that is, while the Germans were murdering the Jews, over a million of them were children. While the Ukrainians were volunteering to join the special squads that would go out and murder, and while the Lithuanians, you know that the, almost all Lithuanian Jewry was murdered during World War II, but they weren't murdered by the Nazis. Almost all of them were murdered by next-door neighbors, by Lithuanians, who just as soon as they were given the opportunity, they just went out and murdered the whole Jewish community. Only about 10% of Lithuanian Jewry survived World War II. While all of Europe, with some a few exceptions, was slaughtering the Jews, or the best stood by silently, there was something strange that was happening. The allies of the Nazis, namely the Japanese, were saving Jews by the thousands. And they weren't saving Jews who were dark-skinned. They weren't saving Jews of North Africa. After all, North African Jewry was in great danger. Had Rommel not failed, what would have happened to Jews in Morocco and so on? They were saving European Jews, Jews that look like you and me. By the thousands. Now, the Japanese, as I mentioned a moment ago, are allies of the Nazis, which makes this all strange. It's not like they decide to do something righteous. So some group that was not even a part of the whole conflict, no, these were the allies of the Nazis. There was a very famous letter that was sent to the Emperor of Japan by Jules Streicher, who was one of the 10 that were executed in Nuremberg in October of 1946. Streicher was executed because he was the propagandist. He was the editor of Der Stürmer. He wasn't convicted for shooting anybody. He made it possible through his material for the literature hatred that was able to drive the Europeans to murder Jews. Of course, he wasn't working with a blank page. He was working with a European society that was pregnant with hatred, that was built on a teaching of contempt, that had scapegoated the Jewish people. He writes a letter to the Emperor of Japan. How could you do this? How could you don't you know what you're doing? You're letting Jews into your country, come and ensconce in your society. They'll take over your banks. And the Emperor of Japan wrote back Streicher a very famous letter saying, essentially, and I'm paraphrasing, my gosh, that's exactly the kind of people we need, and he allowed 9,000 more Jews into the country. How could it be? How is it Shaykh such a crazy thing? Are the Europeans genetically different than Japanese? I don't think so. The difference is that the Europeans were poisoned with literature about the Jews. This type of literature, that the Jews were subhuman, that they have an inner society that controls the world. As you heard Ralph Nader describing a presidential candidate, Congress is Israel's puppet, the Jews control the world, the Jews are parasitical and dangerous people. It's a completely different kind of racism than the kind of racism against black people. White people in America didn't fear black people. They simply considered them less than white people, and therefore were simply property. They weren't afraid of them. The Jews, they were afraid the Jews would conquer them, would destroy them. That was the nature of the Jew. And people say, oh, we have to learn more about each other. We have to, if Arabs and Jews would sit together, they would learn more, and they would go swimming together, and they would jump, they would climb a mountain together. You saw that someday, a Palestinian and an Israeli has climbed up the top of the mountain. They thought this is world peace because they jumped the top of a mountain. A guy and a Jew, they're finished. That if they would sit and climb mountains and swimming and flying in the air together, certainly that would eliminate every problem. We have to just learn more. That's, of course, nonsense. Any study of history will tell you that the people who persecuted us the most are the ones who knew most about our religion, and their religions were closest to ours. None of you here ever walked into a store and was called some dirty word by a Buddhist. Never happened. You wouldn't even know if it happened. They wouldn't know. Why? Why? Because their literature says virtually nothing about you. That's why. And their literature certainly doesn't say anything evil about you. But because the Arab literature, because the Islamic literature, because Christian literature says horrible things about the Jews, it's the literature that demonizes us, and that is the purpose of this. And tonight, we're going to examine the assault on the Talmud and how it designed to demonize the Jews in ways that probably your imagination could not even contain. Many people might ask the question, what is the Talmud? I heard the word Talmud, the Gemara, Mishnah, bantered about, but I didn't go to yeshiva growing up. I'm really not sure what it is, so I'm going to just take it a moment so you'll understand what it is. The Talmud essentially is many things. First of all, it's enormous. Talmud, I think, is nearly 6,000 pages, 63 volumes of the major work of the Talmud. It is compiled of both the Mishnah, which goes back, let's say, to about from 200 BCE to about 200 CE. That part is basically written in Hebrew. And then you have the Talmud part, which is in Aramaic. And those are the students of these individuals. But the word Talmud essentially refers to the body of literature that, number one, records the oral law. Judaism records that when Moses, our teacher, gave us the Torah, he not only gave us the Torah, but he also gave us instructions in how to observe the Torah. What is written in the Torah is the written law, and how to observe it is the oral law. For example, people are confused by this. Some people think the written law has, let's say, people know the 613 commandments, so people think maybe 313 are in the written law and 300 are in the oral law. No, all 613 commandments are in the Torah, are in the five books of Moses. The Torah, the oral law, is to tell us how to do it, how to perform it. It's akin, l'havdol, it's akin to, let's say, you'll take out the Philadelphia Inquirer, right? You'll take a scissor and you'll cut out all the headlines. And you put it on a wall. So if you look at the headlines alone, you'll have a clue of what the story is about, but you won't really know the details, and the details are in the story. So let's take a typical Philadelphia Inquirer day. In the upper right-hand corner above the fold, you'll have a story like, let's say, Israel kills 30-year-old Palestinian boy. It's a typical day, right? So, but you won't know how it was killed and what treachery did Israel commit against this little boy. So that's the details. So the Torah says, as an example, that if you want to slaughter an animal, but it's not for the purpose of sacred sacrifices in the temple, but you want to have hamburgers. So you can't kill an animal anyway. You can't shoot it in the head. You can't bang it or zetz it up. The Torah says in Deuteronomy chapter 12 that you must kill the animal in the manner that I have shown you. Verse 21. So you'll say to somebody, where does it say how to slaughter an animal? So you'll search the Torah all day long, and you'll find it nowhere. That's contained in the oral law. Torah says a person has to wear phylacteries and bind it on their head by the mind. What does it look like? How does it look? How is it to be built? How is it to be designed? That's in the oral tradition. Our sages tell us that although the nations of the world will have access to the written law, they'll know what it says in the written law. And in Parshas Veschanon, in Deuteronomy, it says that the nations will say, what a great people that have such a wise law such as this. But our sages tell us that the nations of the world would never have access to the oral tradition. In fact, every morning you say it in davening, in your prayers. It says, most people say they daven through quickly. They don't realize what they're saying. It says, Magid Devorov Liakov. It's the last verses of Psalm 147. Magid Devorov Liakov. What does that mean? He gave his words, Devorov, his words to Jacob. He told his words to Jacob. The words, the plural, is written in oral law. And therefore, Chukov U'mishpatov LiYisrael. And therefore, Israel has the precepts and the statutes. Loi Osa Chein L'chol Goy. The Almighty has done this for no other nation, and therefore, Mishpatim Bal Yadum Halaluka. Thy precepts, they do not understand, praise Hashem. It's a verse. It pays. Next time, tomorrow morning when you're davening, and maybe it's going a little quickly, it's okay, you slow down and think about what I've just said to you, it'll be a holy thing. And you should know in the King James Bibles, you can't say Dvarov, plural, because they don't believe in the oral law. So you'll see in the King James Bible, it says he gave his words, singular, not words, plural. Although originally the oral law was only meant to be transmitted orally, this was given to Moses orally, he gave it to Joshua, Joshua gave it to the elders, and it was passed on to the prophets. When the children of Israel were enduring perhaps the worst period in our history besides the Holocaust, and that's the period of the destruction of the Second Temple, our people went through a terrible catastrophe. Now we're during the 3 weeks, so we think about this. But in many ways, the destruction of the Second Temple was worse than the destruction of the First Temple. When the First Temple was destroyed, the entire nation, with few exceptions, went to Babylon. And when they went to Babylon after the destruction of the First Temple, there were great prophets and sages who had left earlier, who had arrived there earlier, who had already built great institutions in Babel. So when Jews arrived after the destruction of the first temple that was destroyed by the Babylonians, they came and there were synagogues there. Ezekiel was there. Could you imagine arriving and you have people like Ezekiel waiting for you? Yechezkel, the great prophet, was there. The whole people were together. And they were together in a place where there were already institutions in place. Some Jews did go to Egypt, including the prophet Jeremiah himself. But when the Second Temple was destroyed, that didn't happen at all. When the Second Temple was horrific, deaths in the tens and tens and hundreds of thousands were killed, and the Jews went by slaves. They were spread throughout the Roman Empire. Remember, the Jews represented about 9% of the Roman Empire. Out of 44 million, about 4 million were Jewish. They had lost everything. It was like the lights had gone out. It was horrible. And then in the second century, you had a catastrophe beyond no words. And I'm not going to go in time. We'll never permit this. But you had the whole Bar Kokhba debacle, where there was a revolution that took place to retake the land of Israel back from the Romans. It was headed by Bar Kokhba. It was a very popular movement. And they succeeded. They went back to the land of Israel. They retook Jerusalem. And that lasted until the year 135, 132 to 135. We went through a Hadrian period. The Romans finally, after 3 years, finally were able to reclaim. But imagine if, God forbid, Israel would lose a war, Chas v'Shalom, and the Jews that remained, what would happen to them, and what the Arabs would do with us if we lost the war. In your mind, not one of you has an imagination that can even contemplate such an idea, contemplate such a thought. That's what happened. Wiped out. And as a result of this very dark period in Jewish history, it was no longer possible to allow the oral tradition to pass orally because so much would be forgotten. And it was over this period, and it's really an extended period of time, that the oral law was recorded. It was recorded in notes, and ultimately it was edited, and about 1,500 years ago we have the Talmud of what it is today. About 80% of the Talmud is halacha, Jewish law, and its discussion, its ramifications. Probably about 20% of it is what's called agadata. in its meaning that in the, now halacha is easy to describe. It's Jewish law and it's discussion and arguments and so on. Agadta is basically teachings. Agadta means to tell over stories that carry tremendous moral teachings. The Agadta often are very, very obscure, difficult to understand, highly parabolic, often highly esoteric, although that's not the case. And you should know that because of the nature of Agadata, and specifically of this type of midrashic literature that was only intended to be transmitted from a rabbi to a student, because it's very difficult to understand without it, virtually impossible, it leaves the Talmud and that type of sacred literature highly vulnerable to abuse of those who are enemies of the faith of Israel. The Talmud itself is a very vulnerable document. Even the halachic part of the Talmud, which deals in laws, is very, very vulnerable to abuse as well, and I'll explain why. Because the Talmud is very, very difficult to understand. Very difficult. Why? In fact, among students of the Talmud, a person goes to yeshiva, it is regarded as a very high level if someone can simply read a portion of the Talmud and understand on his own, figure out what the Talmud's saying. It's called make a laning, it's called. Somebody can make a laning. Imagine that you should have a discipline that if you open a book, you don't even, just understand what you're reading. Forget about depth and so on. Just understand what it's saying requires great scholarship. Talmud does. Why? Some people think because it's written in Aramaic. That's not true at all. It's nothing to do with the language. It has to do with the reason why it is virtually a nightmare to understand what the Talmud is saying is because the Talmud is written cryptically. I mean, you have thoughts that are simply missing. The Talmud is essentially a scholarly work and there's a presupposition that the person who's studying it either is already a scholar or is studying at the foot of a master who's a scholar, and therefore huge thoughts are simply missing from the literature. Art Scroll has done something monumental, along with Steinsaltz. What is the great innovation? The Talmud had been translated before. You'll notice that Art Scroll has to add in words that are not in bold to just fill in so you understand what it's even saying. And that's the great innovation of the Art Scroll Talmud. And if you look, you'll see that what they're adding in, and you can always tell because what is in bold in English is literally a translation, and what is not in bold is in a simple, clear font that's interpolated by the translator. You'll see this much more non-bold than bold, which means there are whole huge segments in the Talmud that just aren't there. And therefore the Talmud could only be studied under a master, only be transmitted this way. And therefore, as a result of huge missing thoughts, well, the Talmud assumes that certainly you know what it means, you surely know what it's referring to, this creates an enormous vulnerability. There is another reason why the Talmud is so vulnerable to abuse, and you need to know this. If the Talmud is the compilation of Jewish law for all generations that would follow, there's a huge problem. How could you possibly record every possible case that would ever come up? It's not possible. There's an infinite number of cases and questions that will arise in the future. And the sages were writing a document that was to go for eternity, and from this document, all Jewish law could be derived. Once the Talmud was sealed, it was immediately accepted by all Jewish communities around the world, and that became authoritative. But how do you write a document, how do you record law that any case, possible outcome, could be derived from it when you cannot possibly record an infinite number of cases? It's not possible. Not only that, there will be advances in technology. There'll be new ideas, new philosophies. There'll be new animals that would be discovered, new human conditions that would exist that didn't exist at the time. How is it possible? And therefore, what the Talmud did was the cases that it examined and the cases that it argued over were the most extreme so that everything else could be understood from it. And that's why there are many cases in the Talmud. When the Talmud says, Hocha b'maya askinon, you know what it's talking about here. And the Talmud then tell you a scenario and you read it, if I read it to you, some of you would start laughing. It's absolutely bizarre. It's strange. It makes no sense because these cases would virtually never occur. They would never happen in human life. But just like in a laboratory, when you want to study a chemical, so if you went to high school and college, you took a lab, when they want to know how does one chemical interact with another material, so they don't go to the store and buy ammonia or buy some thing from your Pathmark or whatever you have shopping, right? They have bottles that are hermetically sealed that come from distributors that say on it exactly what it is. It's 100% pure, whatever it is, sodium, whatever it is, in the kind of stinkach poison they put in there. It's perfect. It's a good. Why do they now tell you the truth? Nothing that we use in the real world is perfect. This suit is not 100% wool. There's all kinds of other pigments and all kinds of things. In the real world, nothing is, there's not per wood. There's all kinds of schlack and probably 250 carcinogens to cover this, to protect. How could it be? Why would they use something in a laboratory that would never be used in the real world? Because you want to be sure the outcome, you want to be sure the cause and effect relationship. If you don't have something pure, you're never sure about the outcome. You're not sure what the cause and effect relationship is. So therefore, if you take something that's absolutely extreme, so you know that everything else, let me give you an example. When you open up Tractate Kedushin, so the Mishnah right away begins, first page starts off, a man can marry a woman with three things, with kesef, with money, with shtar, with the document, babia, with the relationship that they have. So right away the Talmud has a question, and that is, if a man can acquire a woman with money, he gives her money, and that's how the marriage is made. Today in a wedding, a man puts on his bride a gold ring on her finger. So the question the Talmud immediately asks is, what's the question? How much money is the minimum amount that a man could acquire a wife with? Okay? Fair question. How much do I need? That's a typical Jewish question. A guy, you say, oh, sounds good. Oh, was she pretty? A Jew's going, well, how much is it going to cost? So right away, as you can imagine, a big discussion, a big fight breaks out. I'm going to transpose it for today's dinner, but it basically is a big argument, Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, of what the minimum amount of value that a man can give a woman to marry her. Okay? So, classical antagonists in halacha and Jewish law. And essentially, Beis Shammai says that the minimum amount that a man has to give a woman in order to marry her is a dollar. Okay? Beis Hillel says a penny. Let's stop right there. I just want to speak to the men for a moment. The women don't have to listen for this part. I'm just talking to the guys. All of you guys know, see some single fellows here. All you guys, you should know. What's your name? Eric. Eric, if you try to marry your bride with either a dollar or a penny, the likelihood is that you will become airborne and fly through a window. That means, in truth, no guy is going to, any woman who gets a dollar or a penny, she's at the window. So what are they arguing? I mean, it's a very bizarre thing. You'll find this constantly in the Talmud, where it narrows in on something and ignores every other issue. Why? Because we know that if it's a dollar or a penny, what ultimately means is that everybody agrees that anything less than a penny is definitely you cannot acquire a woman, and everyone agrees that a dollar or more you can. Okay? And the area of disagreement is extremely narrow. Every other emotional issue is ignored. That's very important for you to understand. The Gemara has cases I wouldn't even go on to. Some of them you wouldn't even believe me. Because it's not interested in the reality of it. It's interested in narrowing on that unique, what are the consequences? By arguing over the dollar and the penny tells us this is the latitude. From that, rabbis later on could then decide infinite number of cases. Because the Gemara engages in such type of extremely scholarly, narrow, hair-splitting arguments, this, by the way, goes against all the arguers. They tell me, say, oh, they argue so much. How could it be from God? How could the Orlo be from God? You see, they're arguing over everything. If you look at what they're arguing over minutiae. They agree on all the major principles, which would be an absurdity. Because of this, it's important to know that the Talmud is therefore also vulnerable to abuse, because it uses extreme cases, and these cases are bizarre. They ignore the reality of life because they're interested in focusing on a cause and effect relationship. What specifically in that area creates a marriage? What doesn't create a marriage? All other issues are ignored. In studying the material of those who are assault and attack the Talmud, there are thousands of websites, many, many, many books. There are three major categories of how accusations against the Gemara are formed. They can fall into three categories that I found. Category number one is that the Talmud contains passages that are blasphemous against Jesus and Mary. Horrible statements in the Talmud about Christianity. Two, The Talmud has ridiculous and immoral statements. I'll explain everything. Number three, that the Talmud has laws that are racist and anti-Gentile. We do not have the opportunity that we're together to go through and examine every single text that they use. It's not possible. Time would never permit it. What I would like to do with you today is examine these three accusations and examine the basic techniques that are used to manipulate, assault, smear the work of our sages of blessed memory. And my hope, of course, is that once you know this, you will know at least where to begin and where to look. This is not an area that's difficult. Virtually all of them, all the accusations and assaults, if you look it up, you almost always see the answer immediately. There are other areas that require other assaults, other slanders, maybe used by the media against Israel, that are more complex. You have to know more about the history of the modern state of Israel, and so on. But with the Talmud, it's usually very easy to identify. The accusations are very base. This type of anti-Semitism is very vulgar. It's very appealing to ignorant masses. The people who write them, they're not worried the slightest bit that someone's going to look up, that someone's going to go into a Beis HaMedrash in Brazil and look up if it actually says it or not. And therefore, the vast majority of the accusations that are made do not even exist. We'll start right there. If you go through any of these websites and you just look it up, in most cases, you'll sit there looking, and it just isn't there. Another technique that's used, which is in all cases, is the text is taken completely out of context, and often the words are mistranslated. Many people ask me the question, who's responsible for all this? Who did it? This essentially started back in the 13th century. Started with, of course, a Jew. Who else? A man, an apostate Jew, one of the great enemies of the children of Israel. Just like today, the greatest adversaries of our people are Jews, whether Noam Chomsky, Norman Finkelsteins, the men and women from the International Solidarity Movement, many of them are Jewish, the Adam Shapiros. In history, great enemies of our nation came from within the nation. Over 300 Jews that spied for the Nazis during World War II, many of them joined the Nazis. Some of the greatest, most miserable enemies of our nation were Jewish. That man in the 13th century, his name was Nicholas Danin. Nicholas Danin was an apostate Jew who first became a Karaite, which is that sect, the cult that rejected the oral tradition. And then he converted to Christianity. And ultimately, he brought to St. Louis the ninth, which the city is named after, and the baseball team, the notion that the Talmud was filled with blasphemy. In France, the Talmud was put on trial in 1242. The defenders of the Talmud at that time were Bali Taisis, the most famous of Rabbi Chil of Paris. He was the leading scholar. It was the same kind of court that just took place in The Hague, judging Israel's fence. It was a bigoted kangaroo court. There was never a chance. You know, Israel never stood a chance in The Hague, and the Jews never stood a chance in the French court. And ultimately, you're going to read about this in 2 weeks from now in Tisha B'Av. Of course, the Talmud lost the trial, and the Talmud, 24 crate loads of handwritten Talmuds were burnt in Paris. A couple decades later, Nachmanides had a debate with Pablo Cristiani, who was also a Jew. He was drawn in by a man named Raymond Martini. These were Dominicans, and Raymond Martini would invent things in the Talmud and Medrash that did not even exist. So that's where the tradition goes, and you have Anton Margarita, a German from in the 16th century, also a Jew, and so on. But the leading individual, the most important work in recent time, is the work written by a Catholic priest. His name is Reverend Justin Prantis. Now, he wrote the book. It's called The Talmud Unmasked. And the subtitle is called The Secret Rabbinical Teachings Concerning Christians. It was written at the end of the 19th century. His bio reads as following. He's a master of theology and professor of Hebrew language at the Imperial Ecclesiastical Academy of the Roman Catholic Church in Old St. Petersburg. The Reverend Prantis was the greatest of students of the Talmud. His complete command of Hebrew language qualified him to analyze the Talmud as very few people in history. This individual, of course, was a virulent anti-Semite, as you can imagine. He lived, obviously, during the days of Nikolai II. He was from this is Tsarist Russia. It's, of course, strange when they say that he was a great master of the Hebrew language and so on, because the Talmud isn't even written in Hebrew, so what help that would give him, nobody's sure. This person you probably never heard of as an author of the book before this program, but you probably know about him because of a case that he participated in, and that was the famous the Bayless blood libel of 1912. And this takes place in Kiev. A Jew, his name was Menachem Mendel Bayless, and he was accused of murdering a 12-year-old Christian boy. This is, again, 1912. This is not 17th century. Although they knew exactly who committed the crime, it was a big trial that took place, and it was an international event. He had great demonstrations. How could you do this? It's not part of Judaism. And the New York Times, at that time, New York Times was not so bad. They had their editorials condemned. It was worldwide condemnation that such a blood libel, such an antiquated accusation and charge were made against the Jews. And the chief individual who brought the foundation for scientific evidence that killing children and using their blood for the matzah was this individual, Reverend Justin Prentice. Okay? The chief rabbi of Moscow was brought there, and he was the one who interrogated him at the trial. We have the minutes of the trial. If you want a great book to read, it's called The Blood Accusation, The Strange History of the Bayless Case. It was written by Morris Siegel. It's published back in 1966. It's readily available. And you can literally read the minutes of how the rabbi questioned his evidence. And I just want to read this to you, because you can see that this was all nonsense. This scholarship was a fraud. I just want to read to you a few Q&As between the rabbi and this reverend. Rabbi Jacob Maza, who's the chief rabbi in Moscow, asked him, "What is the meaning of the word chulin?" The answer, "I don't know." Chulin is the name of a tractate in the Talmud, so if he had knowledge of the Talmud, he certainly know the name of the book. Chulin refers to that kind of food that is profane, meaning is not offered in the temple, that it's not holy, it's not sacred, it's ordinary. That's what that tractate deals with. "What is the meaning of Ervin?" the chief rabbi asked him. Answer? Oh, you read the book. Ervin is also named for tractate that deals with the laws of setting up certain areas that are demarcated so one could, for example, carry on the Sabbath day. "What is the meaning of Yevamot?" His answer? "I don't know." These are the minutes. That's a reference to a Levirate marriage, of a brother who dies and another, the younger brother marries the widow. His following, final question I'll share with you is, "When did Baba Basra live? And what was her activity?" I guess Baba... His answer... Oh, so you know the book Bahat. So now you understand what kind of individual we're dealing with. Let's now go through the examples. First, I told you, the first accusation is that the Talmud contains passages that are blasphemous against Mary and Jesus, that are blasphemous against Christianity. Now, although I'm going to demonstrate to you that this argument is false, it's a completely ridiculous argument. It's just very clear that Judaism doesn't believe in Christianity. It's very clear that in a Christian fundamentalist view, any other religion is blasphemy. If you are not a Christian, that means you don't believe in Jesus the Messiah, you don't believe he's a prophet, you don't believe he was born of a virgin, you don't believe he rose 3 days later, you don't believe, then you are a blasphemer. So why would Judaism be judged by a Christian worldview? I mean, Christianity would be, I mean, we're big boys and girls here, we can talk. Judaism, I mean, in Judaism, Christianity is blasphemous. I mean, let's be frank here. It just needs to be said up front that if Christians are looking for advocates for their religion, they're not going to find it in Jewish literature. It's just a simple matter. All of the sages of Israel, every author in the Talmud, you know, would have died. Any of our sages would have given his life rather than become a Christian. Rashi's own father, the greatest commentator on the Talmud and all of Jewish literature, his father was murdered in the First Crusade because he was a Jew, because he refused to give up his faith. The notion that because someone believes, I mean, even a Christian would concede that if Jesus is not the Messiah, if he's not the Son of God, if he's not God manifest in the flesh, then it's idolatry to believe that he is. Every Christian would concede that. So the whole notion is ridiculous. Another point that needs to be said, Christianity is virtually never discussed in the Talmud, because first of all, it was very unimportant. It was very unimportant because the more you go back in time and in place to the beginnings of Christianity, the less likely it is that you will find anyone that believed in it. As you move away from the first century, from the Christian century, the more likely it is that you'll find people that believe in Christianity. By the way, if you take Mount Sinai, it's the exact reverse. As you go back both in time and in place to Mount Sinai, the more likely it is you'll find people that believe in it, that believe in the national revelation. As we move away from Mount Sinai, well, the less likely it is. And those are two inverted models, and the question is, what do they say to you? Moreover, in Babylon, where the Babylonian Talmud was put together, Christianity had not gone there yet. So it was very insignificant. So although the Talmud will deal with many heretics, and many of them are a big hit in the Talmud and get a lot of ink in the Talmud, Christianity gets virtually nothing. In fact, one could even argue that there's absolutely nothing. It should be said from the outset that because for 2,000 years the church has, without mercy, slaughtered our people and brought unspeakable misery to our nation, there was definitely an antagonism, clearly, that developed among the Jews towards Christianity. This antagonism could be seen in other books that were written by Jews, pamphlets that are not sacred, not holy, certainly. And certainly, if someone murdered your entire family, you're going to have goodwill towards the religion that produces such individuals, just like people today don't feel wonderful thoughts when they think about Islam in the United States, because after 9/11 and after watching what happened to Berg and watching all these horrible people, don't, you know, there's no question about that. But what's important to remember is the way this accusation is made, there are people or movements that are referred to in the Talmud that have nothing to do with Christianity, and they simply, what all of them do, is they take any name that refers to Gentile, let me go through the list, this is their claim, any name such as Minim, Edom, Avodah Zarah, Akum, Ovdei Elilim, Nochrim, Amei Aretz, Kutim, Apikursim, and Goyim all refers to Christianity. So that means anything that says nations, heretics, anything, that means they're talking about Jesus. Second issue is that Yeshu was a very popular name back then. There are a couple of Jesus in the New Testament. The Talmud has 14 people named Hillel, 61 people named Elazar, 61 named Huna, and 8 people called Yeshu in the Talmud. Just a popular name. People don't use that name any longer because it's become equated with Christianity and it's been equated with suffering. Josephus lists 20 different people that are named Jesus and at least 10 of them who lived during the first century. So as a result of this, texts that are used, even in Talmud where you have somebody who was an apikoros or somebody who was an enemy or someone who created problems among the Jewish people, they did not even live during the time when Christianity says that they did, and therefore the Talmud is speaking about them. In fact, when the church says that you had the student of Rabbi Shimon ben Parachia, and he was a seducer, he was a sorcerer, and he was an idol worshiper, and he caused other Jews to sin, and ultimately he was executed, and this is referring to the Jesus of Christianity, and therefore the Jews really the ones admit that they crucified Christ, these are their words. What they're doing is creating an enormous problem for themselves because Rabbi Shua and Parachia lived essentially during the time of Hanukkah, lived 150 years before the first century. And there's actually a theory that's been around for a couple of centuries, and that theory is that there was never a person named Jesus. But what people did was they took this personality that already existed in the Talmud a couple of centuries before. It was like a composite personality of this individual with Hillel, and they put it in, that's how they came with Jesus. And then there's a second individual that lives in the time of Rabbi Akiva named Yeshu, that second century, that also would have nothing to do with it. So if they claim it's Jesus, the problems they create are, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. I want to really spend the remainder of our time on the other two accusations. One is that the Talmud contains bizarre and immoral teachings. What I'd like to do is just go through some of the most common claims, and obviously those claims, when there is, in some sense, some truth to it, that the statement actually does exist, or in some fashion exists. Let me give you a couple of examples. Child molestation is in the Talmud. And any one of these websites, unfortunately, and some messianic websites and Arab websites, they quote a Gemara in Tractate Yevamos 11b. And they quote the Talmud as saying that sexual intercourse with a little girl is permitted if she is 3 years of age. Up to 3 years of age, you can have intercourse with a girl. It's hard to imagine a charge that's more serious than that. I want to quote now the Talmud and what it says. Rabbi Yehuda said the name of Rav. We'll go through the whole text. A male child who has relations with a female adult, and a male child here is referring to a male who's under the age of 9 years old, causes her to be like one who is injured with a stick. Rav said, this is what is meant. An adult male who has relations with a female child, which is, means a child who is under the age of 3, has done nothing at all, because when a girl is less than 3 years old, it's like sticking your finger in an eyeball. Imagine what that kind of lesson does to someone in Paris reading that. That's what it says in Talmud, most revered text. You hear this and you're kind of thrown back. Among pious Jews, people who are very faithful, not only such ideas are unimaginable, a religious man doesn't even touch the hand of a woman who he's not related to or married to. Doesn't sit in a room alone. Doesn't listen to the voice of a woman who's singing, who's not his immediate relative or wife. You go to Meir Sharim, you go to a city where pious Jews are to be found, you never would see even a husband and wife showing enormous physical affection for each other in public. It's considered inappropriate. So such a charge is, of course, is something that's extraordinary. It's a very serious charge. What is the Gemara talking about? If somebody would look at that section of Talmud, you'll see that the Gemara has not talking at all about morality and religious morality. The Gemara says in many, many places that anyone who has relations with a minor, it's as if he raped her. It's ironic that there's so many statements in the Talmud and religious life about the religious approach to a man and a woman and how the relationship should be. Never are these texts quoted. Never, not one of them, because none of them would help their cause. This text is dealing with the issue of what's called a reverse dowry, a ketubah. And the Talmud is dealing with the issue of how much does a woman get to receive for a ketubah. Is called a marriage document, but it's really not a normal document, because a normal document is a bilateral document. In exchange for one thing, you get something else. A ketubah is a completely unilateral document. It's a contract where the man promises the woman that if he divorces her, he will pay her to sustain her if he divorces her. And this protects her. In the world around Judaism, where women were regarded as nothing more than cattle, and that goes on today in the Arab world and places like Saudi Arabia, so thousands of years ago, our sages ensured that women's rights were protected, their lives were protected. In fact, the Gemara says, "Osel yodim shiyeshes ishay afilu sha'achas b'loik suba." It is forbidden for a man to be with his wife even 1 hour without such a document to protect her. Now, not every woman received the same amount of this sort of guarantee. A girl who is a virgin, of who gets married, she's entitled to 200. Units, which is essentially enough for her to live on. And a woman who is not a virgin, she receives 100. Okay, it's very simple. So the Gemara is dealing with the question of what happens if a woman lost her virginity, but not through a sexual act. Let's say a woman lost her virginity because of an injury, as an example. Is that considered, she's considered virgin? Does she get 201? Talmud is not dealing at all with the issue of, is it right? Now, it's not even on the page. It's dealing with what does it constitute, a virgin and not a virgin. So the Gemara, first of all, explains a point, and that is, children, a boy under 9 years old is incapable of being a sexual partner. In halacha, a boy who's under 9 cannot have sex. And if something that simulates sex occurs, we do not regard it as something that's sexual. A girl under 3 cannot have sex halakhically. Moreover, the Gemara says that the bodies of children that are injured are regenerative. We know now, in science, we know that little boys and girls, they finger chop, so they'll grow another finger. That will not happen to adults, but it happens to little children. The bodies are growing, and the bodies little regenerate. And the Gemara says that a girl under 3 years old who physically loses her virginity because obviously she had been raped, so that child, literally, her hymen will regrow, and that it'll be right back intact, as if nothing happened, meaning nothing physical had happened. And the Gemara, using, as I explained earlier, using a language that is literal to understand the point, why? To set up the extremes of Jewish law so all future generations can understand, ignoring all other emotional ramifications, says it's like sticking your finger in an eyeball. What happens? If you stick your finger in an eyeball, what happens? Tears come out of your eyes to wash it away. Now, when those tears come out of your eyes, does your eye then lose the water like spilling a cup out? No. The eye is then able to, whatever is in here is able to produce whatever it is so that more tears can come out of God if you stick your eye in again. There's no shortage of statements throughout the Jewish law about the sanctity of marriage, but it gives you a sense of what happens to the mind of an Austrian who reads such a text. It goes, helps you understand what happens to a Muslim living in Ramallah when he's introduced to such material, that, oh, a people who hold this book sacred, who teach such ideas, of course you can blow them up. Of course you can blow up a girl just a few hours away from her wedding in the Hillel Cafe as she's sitting there with her father, Dr. Applebaum. A nation invent a Holocaust. Only a satanic, demonic people could do such a thing. Then you could stick them in a gas chamber. Then all is there was never a temple. Arafat teaches that directly. Mahmoud Abbas, the prime minister of the Palestinian Authority, now he's in retirement. He wrote a whole book in 1992, The Jews Invent the Whole Holocaust. If you believe these things, and you can believe anything about the Jew. Here's a text. It says here that God himself, quote, now the word here does say God, but it's the quote goes, very popular, it's all over the place. I can't say his name, so I'm going to break it up into pieces. Jehovah, okay? I break it up because I wouldn't even say that, even though there's no J in Hebrew. Himself studies the Talmud standing. He has such respect for that book. It's a quote from the Gemara. Sure. Any of you study Talmud a little bit? Yeah. You know what tractate it's in? It's in Tractate Mechila. Ever study Tractate Mechila? There is no such tractate. Let's go to the final point. Hate racism and hatred towards Gentiles. In the end of December 2003, there was a horrible earthquake in Iran. I think upwards of 40,000 people were killed. It was horrific. They were living in, you know, it wasn't in Tehran in the central city. It was like 100, maybe 600 kilometers away. People were living in like dirt, mud, and everyone was wiped out. Now, Iran is Israel's sworn enemy. Do you think that if Jews would have antipathy towards any people, would have towards these Muslims who despise us, and all day long, what do they think about in Iran? How to develop a weapon to destroy Israel. It's all they dream about all day. And they have a missile now that can go further than Israel, can go beyond into Turkey, and they're now in the course of building a nuclear program, which the world is deeply concerned about. So as you would imagine, even if the Jews were average people, but here your enemy has an earthquake, you think that the state of Israel will be dancing on the streets. Our enemies have problems, right? Not Israel. Israel has some of the most advanced detectors for life under buildings and moving equipment and so on because of the bombing problems it has and dogs to find life, because of what Jews have to deal with every day, because of what Iran does in Hezbollah. It's an unbelievable thing. So Israel wanted to send help to its sworn enemy. What does Iran say? What does the government, the Islamic government, Iran? We don't want your help. We don't want help from Zionists. Amazing thing. So what is Israel? So you think, okay, that's certainly an excuse to get out. You know, people are wondering, it's time to get out. Why do you have to give us our medicine? They're going to get better than kill us. You know, no, it's not good enough. So what does Israel do? Israel then, you talk about the compassion that the Jewish people have for the nations of the world, because we feel responsible for them. We are here. The function of a Jew is to be a light to the nations. So we feel, when we see the Goyim messing up, when we see them sinning, we feel responsible for them. And we feel, you know what the what goes on in the heart of a Jew for the nations of the world when they act this way? We see disappointment. He let us down. That's why in Schindler's List, that was such an important film. That's why you cried your brains out. Many reasons, but basically it hit something in your soul because Oskar Schindler was a German. He was a He person who made money off the war and had women from the war and everything. And if I posit to you that if the hero of that film would have been a Gentile, a Jew, it would not be as meaningful. But we saw, oh, look at this guy. He pulled himself out. He was never an anti-Semite, but he was just an opportunist. But he made himself great and he became a tzaddik. See, why did that hit your soul so hard? Why? And you can see it 20 times and you're crying. You're crying by the time it's over on the floor. You're crying because your soul is crying. You say, oh, look at this Gentile. I'm here to be a light to the nations, and this Gentile pulled himself up. Israel then is told that they can't send food and help to the Iranians who were injured and so on. They were looking for survivors. So Israel then sends medicine and help to other countries to have it relabeled as coming from other European countries, so then those countries then forward it to Iran. That's the kind of nation we have. I ask you, do the Europeans have anything to teach the nation of Israel about compassion? No. Does the United Nations have anything to teach the Jewish people about mercy? No. Does The Hague have anything to teach the Jewish people? No. Setting it up. Jews teach racism towards goyim. I'll give you again just two examples. Most famous one, without a question, quotes a mechilta. It's a mechilta, is like a Talmud because it comes from the same period. Mechilta is essentially a medrash, a volume of midrashic literature that's called halachic midrashim, which is strange because midrashim we usually think of agadita, moral teaching, stories, and so on. But this is a document of halachic works, and it's the same period. And the quote is, Rabbi Shimon taught that it's good, let me just quote it exactly here. Rabbi Shimon said that it is good to kill even the best among the goyim, among the Gentiles. You hear that? So we have here an open proof that the Jews, not only will they kill a Gentile, a Palestinian, you say a Palestinian, what does he contribute to society? No, it's good to kill even the best among the Gentiles. So naturally, what effect does this have on? We don't need an imagination. What is it talking about? The Mechilta, and this statement is also quoted in the Gemara, is talking about when the Jews are at war. When the Jewish people are at war with the enemy, do not consider the status of the ones who are trying to kill you. There's a strange thing going on amongst the terrorists. And all of them are surgeons and doctors and pediatricians and gynecologists. Somehow, if you didn't go through medical school, you can't join Al-Aqsa brigades. You have to be, you're a surgeon? Okay, fine, you could join Al-Qaeda. But the Zahrawi, he's a doctor, and Rantisi, who's in Gehenna, he was the head of Hamas. He was a pediatrician, a surgeon, a pediatrician. Well, and pediatricians are like the nicest. I don't care what kind of doctors in the audience are. The nice doctors in the world are pediatricians. It's a fact. Because what is the person? Why would a doctor go to become pediatrician? It's not the biggest money-making discipline within medicine. It's probably the most difficult, and it's probably the least, you know. But people go in because they love children, you know. They're the ones with doctors with the smiles. Another point is, this is the context, another understanding, and then we'll see in the text, this statement is made that when somebody's coming to attack you, no matter where they are on the scale, you should know that if they're coming to kill you, you have to kill them, even the best of them. And the story we're told is, the example, what the context is, and we'll see it inside, is the fact that when the Jewish people, when they were told by Paro after the 10th plague, they were told, go free, take your people and go. So as before the Jews came to the sea, the Egyptians had a change of mind and they decided that, wait, what are we doing? We're letting them go. These were perfectly good slaves that were serving us fantastic. And they had a change of mind. They went and pursued the Jews. And it says in the Torah, in Parshas Bishalach, that Paro took with him, they put together 600 elite chariots with their best horses, and they went after the Jewish people. So the Mechilta asks the question, how do the Egyptians get animals? Why is this an important question? Because of the fifth plague. In the fifth plague, the animals were all killed. Let me read it to you. Mechelte asks the question, from where did these animals come to drive these chariots? If you're going to say they're from Egypt, so it says in Shemos, in Perek Tes, in the ninth chapter, that the livestock of Egypt died. If you would say that they were from Paro, it says, behold, the hand of God is against your livestock, when he's speaking to Pharaoh. If you're going to say they're from the Jews, that this, they have somehow had Jewish livestock, so it says no. It says that take all your livestock and go. So the Jews took their livestock with them. So where did this livestock come to drive the chariots to pursue to kill the Jews? Rather, it says, they were from the Egyptians who feared God. And if somebody feared God, when they heard that Moses said that your livestock's going to die, and they took the livestock and they put it inside the barns, so those livestock were not affected. And we see from here that the livestock of God-fearers escaped the plagues that caused great hardship for the Jews. And these are the people who were fearful of Moses and actually got scared. It was like the Palestinians who got nervous and ran into the homes and didn't join. And these guys come to kill you. You know, these are Arab citizens of Israel, and yet they plot to kill you. But the citizens, they got Israeli passports. You should know if they come to kill you, you got to kill them. And how do we, and Rabbi Shimon says, even the good among the Goyim who come to kill you, they have to be put to death. That's the kind of crime that's done against our people. And as you'll see, incidentally, next week, the media does the same thing in slandering us and using the same techniques. I want to finish with one last piece. And I'm going to wish you a good night. I guess we'll open up to questions. The last piece has become very popular after Schindler's List came out. The most powerful scene in the film, I think you'll probably agree, is the one of the last scenes when Oskar Schindler is given a ring that was made from the teeth of the inmates, and in gratitude for saving so many lives. And it's a very powerful scene because he, you know, he had emerged from being someone who was a womanizer and someone who was just, you know, someone who was trying to make money off of other people's misery. No, that at the end he becomes a tzaddik. If they saw the girl with the red dress, that was the only color in the film besides the candles. And at the end is the scene where he says, this pen, I didn't do enough. This pen, I could have saved another Jew. This pen, I could have saved. And he starts to cry. And I remember I saw that when I was lecturing in Binghamton. I was speaking at the university there. I mean, I, as you know, I couldn't even breathe. He said the car that he was using to escape, 10 Jews. He could have done more. And the people reassured him that he had done so much to save so many. And he had to run for his life, and they made him a ring, and in the inside of the ring there was an inscription, and the inscription was in Hebrew. And he asked the inmates, what does it say? So he quoted this in the movie. It says, he who saves a single life saved an entire world. As you can imagine, I would even ask you, what could you possibly do with this? If you want to know how vicious our enemies are, this is something so innocent, something so moving. He could have saved himself. He could have, all the money he gave away, all the money that he accumulated, suitcases of money. It's moving, as this is not a movie, it's a true story. How could you possibly find any fault among the children of Israel for this? So you say that, in fact, that's not what it says in the Talmud. Quoting the Gemara in Sanhedrin, the Talmud in Tractate Sanhedrin, which deals with courts and law, what it actually says, the enemies of our people say, is Kol ham abed nefesh achas mi Yisrael, whoever destroys a, this is the whole quote, a single soul among Israel, Ma'alol of Hakosav Kilu, oh, excuse me. Right, as if he destroyed the entire world, Mamiko Olam Kulo, V'chol HaMekayim Nefesh Achas Mi Yisrael, and whoever saves a single Jewish soul, Ma'alol Hakosav Kilu, as though he saved an entire world. Okay, Kain Kolo Olam Kulo. So the anti-Semites claim that this was a Jewish conspiracy to make Judaism appear as though it was a more universalist religion, that it cares about every soul, but really Jews don't think that every soul counts. It's only Jewish lives they count. Of course, the answer to this, of course, is it's nonsense as well. I did not speak to the producers of Schindler's List. Probably I'd like to one day. But this quote was not from this text. In fact, if you're making a film, you would never, and using such a term, which is very well known among the Jews, you would never use this text. The reason is this text really is quite morbid. You would use a different text. The text that was used is a text that appears in the Jerusalem Talmud, not in the Babylonian Talmud, which says, whoever saves a soul as if he saved an entire world. Why does it say in one place from Israel and in one place any individual? And the location is in Sanhedrin 4, verse 1, section 1, which would be on 22a, is because when the section in Sanhedrin, the Babylonian Talmud, which the anti-Semites quote, it's talking, the context is that witnesses in a capital case, a morbid story, that witnesses in a capital case, when people are bearing witness against someone, so they warn him, and there's a whole instructions of what's said to them. Do you understand what you're getting involved in? The court says to them, wants to frighten them. Are you sure that the testimony that you have here is not hearsay, but it's from you? Because you understand you're going to kill somebody with your testimony. Your testimony has the potential to put a person to death. And there's a whole series of instructions, literally, that you read it and you start to shake. And then, again, then it turns to the witnesses and says to them that if you destroy one soul in Israel, it's if you destroy the whole world. If you take an innocent life among the Jews, because that's the context, it's witnesses against a Jewish person who's being accused. Change one word, you misquote one thing, and suddenly you have a completely new message. I want to end just by reading you this one little piece. I like ending by reading a little piece to you. It's a short little essay written by a Russian writer. I chose Tolstoy because Tolstoy lived in a world, in a Russian world, that was viciously anti-Semitic, and that his contemporaries, it means fellow writers, were viciously anti-Semitic. Russian literature produced at that time was all pregnant with hate against the Jewish people. And yet he was a different kind of person. He was a person that certainly, as he grew older, condemned anti-Semitism. And he wrote a little essay on the Jews that I'd like to read to you. What is a Jew? That's how he begins. Let us see what kind of peculiar creature the Jew is, which all the rulers and all the nations have together and separately abused and molested, oppressed and persecuted, trampled and butchered, burned and hanged. In spite of all this, is alive. What is a Jew who has never allowed himself to be led astray by all the earthly possessions which his oppressors and persecutors constantly offer to him in order that he should change his faith or forsake his own Jewish religion? The Jew is that sacred being who has brought down from heaven the everlasting fire and has illuminated with it the entire world. He is the righteous source, spring and fountain, out of which all the rest of the peoples have drawn their beliefs and religions. The Jew is the emblem of civil and religious toleration. Love the stranger and the sojourner, Jews are taught, and of such a lofty and ideal religious toleration, not even the moralists of our present day can boast. The Jew is the emblem of eternity, he whom neither slaughter nor torture of thousands of years could destroy, he whom neither fire nor sword nor inquisition was able to wipe off the face of the earth, he who was the first to produce the oracles of God, he who was for so long the guardian of prophecy and who transmitted it to the rest of the world. Such a nation cannot be destroyed. The Jew is as everlasting as eternity itself. Good night and thank you.